You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Our guest is in the Baseball Hall of Fame, winner of the Ford C. Frick Award for Broadcast Excellence. He was the first television analyst to win it. For an entire generation of baseball fans, over 30 years, he was the face and voice for the NBC Game of the Week and the Toronto Blue Jays and the New York Yankees. In that time, he broadcast 11 World Series, 14 American League Championship Series, and 10 All-Star Games. That life began after playing shortstop for the dynastic Yankee clubs, debuting as the American League Rookie of the Year in 1957 and playing through 1965. He appeared in 6 World Series in 9 seasons. Long after playing and broadcasting, he began very important work in his native Wisconsin, working with immigrants. With the issue of immigration on the legislative docket for Congress this year, who better to talk about his selfless work than Tony Kubek, the Hall of Famer? Great to have you on my podcast. Thank you, Tony. How did this work with immigrants begin?
Well, after I retired, of course, and I had seen Hmong faces in our community. I live in a town called Appleton, Wisconsin. California has the greatest number of Hmong who had come there from after the Vietnamese War.
And there may be people who don't know about the Hmong. So talk, if you will, about them. They come from Vietnam.
Right. Well, they actually came down and migrated to China. There's still a lot of Chinese. They're Hmong in Chinese. They're a completely different ethnic group. They're not Chinese. They are from Southeast Asia. They migrated down into Laos, into Thailand, and also they were traced out of many places. They're kind of a migratory population ethnic group with their own language, their own culture, etc. They're kind of agrarian, and when they helped us, even though many people feel the war in Vietnam was a little bit of a farce, our CIA set up what they called a secret city in Laos. It was almost on a plateau. They hired, didn't give much money, who became a general of the Hmong, General Vang Pao. He organized about 30,000 Hmong. Some don't even really have the exact number. They were the ground fighters in the Laos and Vietnam. They were guerrilla fighters. They were jungle fighters. Our troops didn't know how to fight in the jungle when the communists, backed by the Laotian communist government, by the Chinese and by the Russians, came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. These were the guys that gave up their lives and were left stranded by our government, very honestly. When we left and pulled out after there was somewhat of a peace treaty, a lot of them were massacred. Massacred was almost genocidal. They were led into our country, many into California, many into Minnesota, many into Wisconsin, and several other countries also, like Australia, New Zealand, and so forth. So basically, they were trying to assimilate into our culture, and because of the difference of the color of skin, whether it's black or whether it's Native American, there's always going to be a little bit of bias, a little bit of bigotry, and there's a segregated society. So we, basically, how I'd gotten involved, my family and some other people, we sold a home, and we had some extra furniture. So I went down to the Hmong American Partnership. I'd never even talked to a Hmong person before. And a fellow there named Lou Lee, he was running the Hmong American Partnership. He said, I've got somebody who you might be interested in who needs some furniture. His name was Tunu Mua. There are like about 18 clan names. Mua happened to be this one. I met him at his desk. His English was decent. He said his family, which had 8 children at the time, he was working, his wife was working, several of his older children were working. So what we did was we carted some furniture over to this house. And next thing you know, I got to know him a little bit with his 8 children and his wife. And then he introduced us to a few more Hmong people. And one day we got a group of people together. We gathered a whole bunch of furniture, some warm clothing, some other things. We tried to help them in that way. And then the program just grew and grew. The first session we had was out of a Lutheran church. They had their playground. We got the kids outside. We got them inside. We fed them a little bit. We had crafts. We had people who taught them art. Some of our women in the program, they taught some of the Hmong women English, basic English verbiage, and how to communicate in grocery stores. And from there, after 8 kids the first day, by the end of the week, we had 24. And then in subsequent years, we had up to 120 kids, from mid to late teens to way down into preschool. And as we grew to know them, we got to know how they fought for us in Vietnam, how they died for us. And when they were in Vietnam, if you listen to some of the generals who trained them and some of the majors and the colonels and so forth, they taught them how to fly. They flew dangerous missions. Some of our jet pilots wouldn't fly. They flew a little, they called T-28 airplanes, and went into these valleys when the Ho Chi Minh Trail was being used to get supplies down to their troops in Laos and Vietnam. And they lost a lot of lives. And so we just got to love them. When they got to our community, you know, as they are in most, they're very industrious. They're very education-minded. They really are upward bound. They just are very loving people. Ed, I think one of the most, not just interesting, but most meaningful things that I personally, my wife ever did was, we used to take some people down to Milwaukee, that's about an hour and a half drive away from where I am right now, south, for citizenship. We took one lady who was a Mua also from that clan, and my wife sat in the back seat grilling her with 100 questions that were given to anybody in our country would be once become a citizen, and at random they picked 25. And my wife grilled her when we put her through security to go upstairs to the immigration office. She was a little bit timid, a little bit frightened. When she came out and she stood on the top of the S there and yelled, "I made it!" And everybody, the guards, everybody were just thrilled. 2 weeks later, we went down to Milwaukee to the county courthouse, and it was a judge had the swearing-in ceremony. There were 46 countries represented, about 150 people from 46 different countries sworn allegiance to the United States of America. And it was so touching. It was just remarkable. And when she got her citizenship papers, because her husband, who was very ill from the Agent Orange that was sprayed to defoliate in Vietnam, he had kidney problems. He just died a few years ago, as a matter of fact. He fought, so he was still alive at the time. So he got to see her become a citizen. She'd gotten a job. She worked well. And it was just so fulfilling to have the time and to get to know this particular ethnic group and how loving and caring they are and how they fit in our community. As we go around Appleton, we've got a town of about, I'd say, 70,000 people. And so many of the new shops, they're entrepreneurs also, might be an Asian market, might be an Asian little restaurant. And if a building is vacant in our downtown area and it's not big, they or some of the Latinos will try and start their business, and it takes care of a lot of the needs of food, not just of their people, but they're just excellent cooks, and they're very hospitable, and they're very generous with their time and everything else. So it's been a great experience for us. And we did that for 12 years, and it was very fulfilling.
This is not strange work for the Kubek family. Margaret, your wife, was a social worker, and your four children, two boys, two girls, had jobs that were in the service to others. This is what the Kubeks do.
Well, I've got when somebody asked me how this all happened, I said, well, you know, for most of my life, my job-filled life, I was traveling, whether it was in baseball where I'd be gone 2 weeks. Of our four children, two boys and two girls, I was only home for one of their first. The other times I was at Yankee Stadium, and Pete Sheehy, the old clubhouse guy, called me into the dugout when they had television and said, "Your wife wants to talk to you." And both times at September 6th, the year apart, 62 and 63, our first two boys were born, and I talked to my wife in the Yankee dugout during batting practice. And then we played the Detroit Tigers one of those years. It was a pennant year. So, yeah, my wife is a social worker. I have a daughter now, our youngest daughter. She just got married a few years ago. She's a professor, teaches master's program at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, social work master's program. She's got a degree in anthropology also, and so she's a professor there. Our other daughter, she's got a nonprofit, 501c3. She works with kids on the autism spectrum, kids who have dyslexia, brain trauma injuries, so she's able to do that. So it's been kind of nice to hang around the female side of our family. Both of our boys were in the teaching profession too at one time, and so it comes through her genes, not mine. I tried to teach them baseball, but a couple went to soccer and some other sports instead.
And I was going to ask you that. Do any of these thousands of people, Tony, that you've worked with, have any idea of your history on the field or off the field? Because millions know the name Tony Kubek and know your face.
Well, in the Hmong population, I don't think so. But after we kind of we didn't get dismissed from the Hmong program, it's still going on to not as big a scale as it was. I got certified to teach English, so we started a program with Latinos and some other Hispanic countries also. So all I've got to do is some of my Mexican friends, my Latino friends, say, "Do you know the name Fernando Valenzuela?" Oh, Fernando, and that's a good connection to have. So yeah, I think some of the latter Hispanics, like we've had some Puerto Ricans and some from Central America that I've taught, and I try to do it on a one-on-one basis, so that's been interesting too. So it's just been something to get involved in different cultures, and I think as I look back at my career with the Yankees, I start saying, during that Vietnam War and so forth, when you become so self-absorbed in your job and in baseball or whatever it might be, you don't even know what's going on in the real world. That's kind of sad. It wasn't my part anyway. So it was time to say, hey, let's get on with a different life than something that's fulfilling. But I can always go back and say, the culture on the Yankees, even though Ellie Howard was the first African-American player, Jackie for the Yankees. Jackie went through a lot. I'm sure Laurie Doby did too, the first American League African-American player. But Ellie Howard and his wife Arlene did too, and they tried to get a home in New Jersey. And then I saw Pedro Ramos when we got him for a while. It was Cuban, and we had Hector Lopez from Panama. And then I can recall very vividly when Pedro Gonzalez, a Dominican player, come up.
Right.
Was trying to take Bobby's job, and he could not get a place to live. The hotel that we all stayed in, we were single, was up on 161st and Grand Concourse.
You stayed at the Concourse Plaza.
You bet. And they didn't have a room for Pedro. And I said, in retrospect, bigotry, segregation, discrimination showed its ugly head, as it still does in this day and age.
And you have helped Latinos in this work with their everyday needs. You have started a scholarship program. You've gone out for immigrants to buy rice for families in need.
Well, that's been kind of a neat thing. And it wasn't just that I didn't spearhead this whole thing. It was a group of men and women, and the women were just, the maternal instincts were very important. With people who knew a few words, the kids who went to school were integrated into pretty much because they spoke the English, because at school they were taught that. But some of the first generation, even the second generation, their language skills and overcoming some of the burdens from our culture and theirs. One of the first books I read was written by a gal named Anne Fadiman. Father was a journalist in New York, and mother was a World War II correspondent. She wrote a book called, I read it many years ago. It was about a young Hmong girl in California, the first generation family, spoke New English, who had severe epilepsy. And with the culture of the Hmong, the shaman and the spiritism, the animism is so strong in their culture, and then try and take that young girl who had severe epilepsy to a doctors who were kind, but they couldn't understand the culture of that, of the Hmong. They couldn't understand. And this Anne Fadiman wrote a marvelous book, but not just about this little girl and the problems between the cultures and the assimilation of that culture into our society, and how she told the story of the girl and how she did that. And then there was another book I wrote that was told to me by a friend of a friend. Christopher Robbins wrote a book called The Ravens, which is all about our secret CIA force up in Laos, a city called Long Chien, which almost every house I went into was first generation. They had a big thing on their wall with this plateau in Laos where our CIA planes used to land, and Vang Pao, their famous general, had these troops out in the jungles, getting shot down and everything else, and dying from starvation and during the monsoon season and everything else. So we got to learn some by reading books about that culture, but mostly by just talking to people. I mean, just being around them. I'd get a chance to go into an Asian market and buy a soda or buy a bag of rice or something and get to talk to people, as all of our people involved in the program did. And so it was a very it was worthwhile for a lot of people. We see now one of our girls just we knew her since first grade. Her name was Maisie Tao. Tao is another Hmong clan name. She just got her degree. She's a physical therapist. She just got out of school. Her older sister, Petra, is a fourth grade teacher for the last 2 years. She went through our system, trained school for teachers. She's a fourth grade teacher. She's got two other sisters, both of whom has married, have children. They both have real good jobs here. And it's just, you say, well, why did we do this? Not that we do that just to get any glory or anything like that.
No, of course not.
This is just wonderful that, you know, these kids now fit in. Some of them have jobs or they've got people underneath them. We've got one girl, another Tao, T-H-A-O, who got a master's degree, and she's going into the medical profession from the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. So you look at some of the success stories and how industrious these kids are, how they've had to struggle through some of the things, not just culturally, but some of the animosity that is spewed out, not just verbally, but in many other ways to people of a different culture and a different color. So it's kind of neat to see some of it. And we still have these friends. We still see them quite often, not as often as they've grown up. Some have families now, but it's been a lot of fun. You know, I've said to somebody else, somebody said to me, why do you do this? I said, you ought to try it. I don't want to be the only one having all this fun. and it is. Aside from that, it's very fun. It's a lot of fun meeting new people.
In our remaining moments with the great Tony Kubek, as you said, you've made so many friends along the way, and these are lasting friendships. You've watched these people's kids grow up. But before you go, with immigration on the supposedly on the legislative docket for Congress this year, I'm interested in knowing, what do you make of the immigration issue, the debate, the portrayal of immigrations right now, and what would you do? What do you think is right?
Well, you know, it's interesting with what has happened in the political arena and some of the thing with harassment and so forth. Al Franken, who just resigned, the senator from Minnesota, and Klobuchar, another, both Democrats, and they really had bills passed because there's still so many Hmong being persecuted in the communist country of Laos. They're chasing them down through the mountains. They're shooting them. It's almost a genocidal thing. And they tried to pass bills, which kind of now have disappeared from trying to help out, some of those people in Laos, communist country. We had Laos isolate a little bit, and I know some Hmong friends who have gone back there. In fact, some of the girls I just mentioned, their mother is in Laos right now. She goes back to her old village. She speaks very little English, Chumizhong Tao. And she goes back to the village every couple of years. She saves her money. The kids help get her money so she can go see her relatives back in Laos. And just really going back to hope they're still alive, because sometimes they're just disappearing. But that legislation was stymied, is again, and is there a solution? Are there problems? But it isn't going to be a wall that's going to prevent this. It's going to be getting to know people, helping them get jobs, helping them get educated, not shutting off funding to those that have helped us, whether it's the Mexican population or it's the people that went through it's almost like throwing it back to World War II, where they call them internment camps when all the Japanese during World War II. Those were concentration camps. They call them refugee camps now in Thailand. I have a friend who's now a successful insurance agent here. He was in Laos, and there's a river called the Mekong River, which is kind of a border river.
Sure.
In order to get out away from Laos and the communists who were terrorizing them, they had to get into what they call the refugee camp in Thailand. They swam the Mekong River at night. They hid in the daytime. Nick was a good swimmer, and it's a treacherous river. I think it's like one of the 7 or 10 largest, roughest rivers in the world, bigger than the Mississippi, longer and more volatile. His father didn't swim. There were 35 to 40 members of his family. He tethered his father, and because he was the best swimmer, had him on his back at night. A Viet Cong boat with spotlights, machine guns, bunch in the group. Nick was able to get below the water. He survived. He had to cut his father loose and floated dead down the stream. When Nick got to the other side, he turned around, swam back to get more of his own clan members. But those are the kind of stories you hear. And those who, one, Nia Chai Mua, who was a shaman, I got to know him very well. He was in a foxhole when they were bombing over in his village. He had his ears completely deaf, he still got here. He was a pleasant guy. His kids would translate what he said for me when I went into their homes, which was very frequently. And I had the time to do it, and it was kind of nice. But when you hear the story, and there are many, many more, and I can tell you a story about Latinos who are undocumented, who have come across to just have a better life, who were incarcerated for a while and then tried again and tried again. But you can't be cruel to these people. Are there some, just like the white population or any other else? Yeah, there are some. But they're the minority that are here to hurt us. They want to make a better life for themselves. And I found out they make a better life for us, too, in many, many, many more cases.
And for all the right reasons, all of them being selfless, you have done, and your family has done, God's work.
Well, the church is, in many denominations, we happen to be Lutheran. We're a conservative Orthodox body of Lutherans called the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. There's a wide spectrum of Lutherans, as there are Catholics also. And there was a church available. We started the program there. People chipped in, and they found it very fulfilling. And it isn't something they did, not one that I knew, and there were a lot of people involved. Not one that I knew that did it because, boy, it makes me feel so good. It does, but that's not the real reason for doing it. It's because it helps them. It helps them feel good. And it's just showing just good Christian love is what it is. And if you're able to do it, then I had the time to do it, and I could. And people accepted me to do it. I was not the leader of the group, but I was a little part of it, and that made it even better for all of us.
Sounds typical Tony Kubek. So that'll do it for Tony Kubek and myself on MLB.com. If you were on the move, thanks for the ride. And thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.